Hello, everyone. My name is Paul Mather, and I'm a professor of clinical medicine at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. And it's my pleasure today to speak to you about the treatment of acute and chronic heart failure. So the outline and overview of this particular segment will be we're going to spend some time talking about the diagnosis, initial evaluation, and the management of acute decompensated heart failure, and then we'll transition into the management of chronic heart failure. So the first question we always have to ask is, does the patient have heart failure? Some of the common symptoms in acute heart failure are breathlessness, wheezing, edema, and fatigue. Obviously, that can be caused by multiple things, but these are the most common symptoms associated with acute heart failure. More subtle symptoms are abdominal pain, especially in the young, nausea, anorexia, confusion, and lethargy. So the first question we ask is, does the patient have heart failure? And if that requires a clinical exam, physical markers, and then blood tests and imaging studies. So one of the first things we talk about is the physical exam. What is one of the most common markers for diagnosing heart failure? Jugular venous pressure or distension is critical. That is one of the most common physical findings because most physical findings have a poor sensitivity, but JVD has the best sensitivity in the physical exam. Other physical findings that have poor sensitivity are an S3, Rawls, and peripheral edema. All of these are helpful when present, but are often absent in patients with acute heart failure. So the initial evaluation should focus on the degree of congestion and the volume status of the patient, the adequacy of perfusion, and if there are any triggering factors and comorbidities. When I talk about degree of congestion and volume status, I'm talking about are they well perfused, otherwise known as warm, and are they euvolemic, otherwise known as dry, or are they well perfused warm and volume overloaded wet, or are they low perfused state, we call it cold, and euvolemic dry, or are they in a low perfused state, cold, and volume overloaded, wet? So we summarize that, are the patients warm and dry, warm and wet, cold and dry, or cold and wet? And that will answer your volume, which is the dry or wet part, or adequacy of perfusion, which is the warm or cold part. So once we figure that out, we also need to discuss what may have triggered all this. Well, the most common cause of triggered acute decompensated heart failure is noncompliance with medications and diet. The second most common cause is poorly controlled hypertension. Number three is ischemia or acute coronary syndrome. Cause number four is arrhythmias such as atrial fibrillations. And then there are other things such as infection, pulmonary emboli, and worsening renal function. Once we have diagnosed somebody with heart failure, and you use your clinical exam, you use your laboratory tests, and one of the laboratory tests people always check is a BNP, natriuretic peptide. The problem with the natriuretic peptide use is that there are multiple things that can change its value, and it's also important to know what the patient's baseline is. So the only time I use natriuretic peptides is when I know somebody's euvolemic baseline, and if they also have concomitant COPD or emphysema, and then it becomes a useful tool. So once we've made the diagnosis of acute heart failure, what is some of our contemporary pharmacotherapy? Well, the most common drug used in 90% of the cases is diuretics. Other drugs used are dopamine, dobutamine, milrinone, niseretide, and nitroglycerin. And these are for acute intravenous therapies for acute heart failure. Let's talk a little bit about the diuretics. And I always use the movie phrase, the good, the bad, and the ugly. IV loop diuretics are the mainstay of therapy in acute heart failure and given to approximately 90% of patients. They relieve symptoms of dyspnea and edema in most patients, but they're also associated with a variety of problems, including electrolyte abnormalities, activation of renin-angiotensin aldosterone system and sympathetic nervous system, diuretic resistance, worsening renal function, and increased mortality. One of the things to talk about is diuretic resistance. In heart failure and chronic kidney disease, both disease processes are associated with relative diuretic resistance. There's something called a braking phenomena where there's a decrease in response to diuretic after the first dose has been administered. There's a long-term cause of diuretic resistance called tubular hypertrophy, which occurs to compensate for salt loss. Other therapies to remove fluid include ultrafiltration, but they're a little more complicated and require subspecialty involvement, and certain centers may not have the ability to quickly mobilize such therapies. So our current therapies include diuretics to reduce fluid volume and vasodilators to decrease preload and afterload, which include nitroglycerin and potentially neseretide. And then we have inotropes or inodilators such as milrinone or inotropes such as dobutamine to augment contractility. So how do we choose vasodilators? We have nitroglycerin, neseretide, nitroprusside, and milrinone, which is an inodilator, as I just stated. We use those in order to change precapacitance and create vasodilation. According to the 2009 ACCF and AHA guidelines, which was updated in 2013 by the Heart Failure Society, there's a class 2A indication in patients with evidence of severely symptomatic fluid overload in the absence of systemic hypotension, and that's a very important phrase, in the absence of systemic hypotension, to use vasodilators such as intravenous nitroglycerin, nitroprusside, or neseretide to augment diuresis in those who do not respond to diuretics alone. So it is felt at a level of evidence C with a indication 2A that these vasodilators may be beneficial. The problem with inotropes is that they're a two-edged sword. If you look at the Optime CHF trial, which was a milrinone trial, there was no statistical significance in length of stay and discharge to 60 days versus placebo in those treated with milrinone. And there were higher death rates in the milrinone arm in ischemic cardiomyopathy patients, but less in non-ischemic patients. There was increased in-hospital adverse events in the milrinone group across the board in treatment failure from adverse events, sustained hypotension, acute MI, AFib, and mortality. So these drugs are used to augment forward flow and improve contractility, but there is the price to pay. And certainly, invasive monitoring with Swan-Ganz catheterization also has a lot of deleterious effects, including infection and bleeding and pneumothorax and other iatrogenic causes. So in summary, with acute decompensated heart failure, one has to decide on the trigger, the perfusion status, the volume status, and use augmented therapies to try and improve the volume and improve the contractility. However, one of the most important things in the acute heart failure patient trajectory is the discharge and the transition. What we have found in statistical analysis and research programs is that the handoff is the most dangerous time for the patient. What we recommend in all in-hospital heart failure patients is that all exacerbating factors are addressed: ischemia, arrhythmias, compliance issues, hypertension issues, that near optimum volume status is observed, that transition from IV to PO diuretics is successfully completed, patients and family education is completed, including clear discharge instructions, the LVEF is documented, including the size of the ventricle, other triggers such as smoking cessation is counseled, near optimal pharmacologic therapy is achieved, including ACE inhibition and beta blockers for reduced ejection fraction, and intolerance is documented. If it's not an ACE inhibitor due to allergies, maybe it's an angiotensin receptor blocker or a new category of drugs called the angiotensin receptor neprilysin inhibitor. There's one drug now under the brand name Entresto. And that, most importantly, follow-up clinic visits are scheduled usually within 7 to 10 days. All acute heart failure patients should be considered for this type of analysis before they are discharged to decrease their comorbidities and to decrease readmissions. Some of the criteria that can affect readmissions are making sure that their oral medication regimen is stable for 24 hours. They have not been on intravenous vasodilator or inotropic agents for at least 24 hours. They are ambulating before discharge to assess functional capacity after therapy. There are plans for post-discharge management, including as simple things as scale present at home, visiting nurse or telephone follow-up, generally no longer than 3 days after discharge, and referral to disease management if possible. Even if you do this, there are readmissions. As I said, handoff and communication to the next provider of care is key. It's key to minimize transition errors. Medication and dietary compliance is important. 30 to 50% of patients with acute decompensated heart failure are discharged still volume overloaded, so that has to be taken care of. And obviously here you're fighting length of stay versus readmission. And I have found in my own practice, the longer the length of stay, the less the readmission. It's like an accordion effect. And we also have to analyze competing priorities for patients, such as cost of medications, cost of food, especially in the urban environment, food deserts, and competing stressors on the patients. So in summary, acute decompensated heart failure, number one, analyze the triggers. Number two, get them to euvolemia and good perfusion status. Number three, deal with the dangers of transition. And four, have a very definitive follow-up.